Hello, and welcome to this podcast presented by LexisNexis. Because the law is everywhere, at the heart of our lives and our discussions, this series brought to you by LexisNexis and guests will cover current issues that impact us daily. I am joined today by James T. Casey, Jason Cully, and Michelle Casey, authors of the book, The Law of Regulatory Investigations in Canada, which published in March 2023. James T. Casey is a partner working in Field Law's Edmonton office. His primary areas of practice are administrative law, professional regulation, and acting as a labor arbitrator. James founded the firm's professional regulatory group and acts as legal counsel to numerous professional organizations. Jason Cully is a partner working in Field Law's Edmonton office. He primarily serves clients in the practice areas of professional regulation and labor and employment. As a member of Field Law's professional regulatory group, Jason serves as a legal advisor for a variety of professional regulatory organizations. Michelle Casey is an associate at Lawson Lundell LLP in Vancouver. She is a member of the firm's litigation group with a focus on regulatory litigation. Michelle's practice includes advising on provincial and federal regulatory regimes, assisting clients with regulatory compliance, and defending clients charged with administrative penalties. Thank you all for being here and taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you, Monica. I'm going to start off with a discussion about the concept of the book. There were two main drivers behind our decision to write The Law of Regulatory Investigations in Canada. Firstly, investigations are an integral part of virtually every regulatory scheme. If you have an enforcement mechanism in the statute, then chances are it's going to have an investigative phase. And of course, investigations are much more prevalent than hearings. If you have one hearing, you might have had in a certain regulatory regime 10 investigations or 20 investigations that did not result in hearings. And of course, there's a myriad number of complex and important legal issues that arise in the investigative phase. So that was the first driver. The second driver for writing the book was that Michelle and Jason and myself found that there was no comprehensive multidisciplinary legal textbooks on regulatory investigations. Most of the general administrative law textbook tended to focus primarily on the adjudicative phase of regulatory proceedings rather than on the investigative phase. Now, if you were looking at a textbook in a particular area, in a particular regulatory regime, such as environmental law or securities or professional regulation, then those textbooks, they do tend to mention investigations and address to a certain extent the issues that arise. However, the issues that arise in environmental litigation or securities litigation or privacy, they tend to be common across all regulatory regimes. And of course, there are some issues that are statute specific, but the general types of issues that arise are multidisciplinary in nature. And you know, this is the same as when I wrote the Regulation of Professions in Canada 30 years ago. There were textbooks on individual professions, but not a multidisciplinary approach that looked across professions, and the issues that arise tend to be of the same general nature. And so this is the concept for the book. We wanted a multidisciplinary focus that addresses investigations and case law in a broad range of regulatory regimes, including professional regulation, police discipline and oversight, environmental regulation, occupational health and safety, labor standards, financial regulation, securities regulation, human rights, competition law, privacy, to name just a few, because the issues that arise are the same. So those are the two main drivers behind the book: the importance and prevalence of investigation in regulatory regimes and the complex and challenging legal issues that arise, and the need for a comprehensive multidisciplinary book that covers the full range of regulatory context. So, Jason, can you give us an overview of the topics that are covered in the book?
Certainly, Jim. As you indicated, there's a number of those complex and important issues which arise in an investigation. So the book has a chapter focused on a number of those different subjects and issues that arise. There's, of course, the introduction to regulatory investigations, general discussions of the law that would apply in those variety of circumstances. There's a chapter on jurisdiction and statutory compliance, which addresses the fundamental topic of when a regulator is able to proceed with an investigation and what might be required by that statute. As you indicated, Jim, of course, there are certain statutory issues unique to different regimes, but also some more common ones. There's a chapter on the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which raises a number of substantial issues, although even though it is different than the criminal law proceeding, a number of those topics bleed over into the issue of a regulatory investigation. There's a chapter about the duty to cooperate, on how it can differ from those involved and what that exactly involves. There's other topics include interim orders and investigative powers, as well as confidentiality, privacy, and privilege, which is an important topic given the impact on an investigation process that those issues can have, as well as on the ability to collect and disclose documents, which is a fundamental part of any investigative proceeding. There are also additional chapters on parallel investigations and proceedings, certainly about issues about the order of those different proceedings arising and the use of information between them. Additionally, there's a chapter on procedural fairness and the reasonable apprehension of bias, as well as the important topic of delay in administrative proceedings, which has always been an important topic. But given the more recent decision from the Supreme Court of Canada in the Law Society of Saskatchewan and Abermitts, that has a continuing and renewed focus of pressing concern for regulators, particularly at the investigation stage. And finally, there's a chapter on challenges to investigative decisions, how those challenges can be brought, and certainly what issues may arise. So as you can see, given the number of very different topics and chapters included in the book, really focusing on those complex and myriad of issues that you mentioned that are covered.
Thanks, Jason. Michelle, what are your thoughts on the target audience for this book? In other words, who do you think would find the book to be useful?
I think because of the really, as you're talking about, Jim, the multidisciplinary approach to this book, the target audience for the textbook is actually quite broad. Two of the main groups we were thinking about when we were writing were law firms and regulatory agencies. So first, we were really thinking about law firms generally and administrative law lawyers in particular when we were framing up the book. This is lawyers working in any regulatory areas with an enforcement or investigation component, which is virtually all, or at least many, many of the regulatory areas. And Jim, you mentioned some of these practice areas: environmental law, financial regulation, professional regulation, human rights, etc. So quite a broad practice area for law firms and lawyers. The second audience that we were really thinking about, as I said, was regulatory agencies and professional regulators. These groups encounter administrative law issues when employing their investigative processes and would really benefit from the topics that we've covered in this textbook. There are two other audiences that we were thinking about. One is investigative companies. As they conduct their investigations, they can refer to the text for direction as legal issues arise in their work. And a fourth category would be law libraries, for example, law school libraries, courthouse libraries, law firm libraries as well. Libraries who want to provide a comprehensive collection to their patrons. And as you said, Jim, we think that this textbook fills a gap in many of those collections. So that's who we were thinking about, and that's who we think this textbook will really help in the day-to-day practice.
So Michelle, we heard Jim mention that he's also the author of The Regulation of Professions. Unlike Jim, this was your first experience writing a book. So did you find anything particularly surprising or interesting in that process of writing?
That is a good question. And yes, it was. I was going to say this was my first time writing a legal textbook, but it is my first time writing any type of book, to be fair. So there were actually quite a few things that surprised me through the process. The first one is how much the writing process deepened my understanding of this area of the law. You know, as an administrative law lawyer, many of the issues covered in this textbook are things that I had come across in my practice. But in practice, those issues often arise, you know, one at a time and always in a very particular factual context. It's not common in practice that we have the chance to sit back and look at a whole body of law together before diving into our particular issue. But that's what the process of writing this book provided. It was an opportunity to take for each of the issues a step back, to look at the whole, to really think about it as a whole, and then dive into the details. So I found that to be a really engaging exercise, and it gave me a different perspective on the issues than I get in my day-to-day practice. A second thing that I found surprising, it's not something substantive, but I was really surprised by how creative the process of writing a legal textbook could be. I went into this project thinking, you know, I'm just taking an existing body of law, organizing it, making it readable, making it digestible. What I didn't appreciate was that actually doing that, the organizing, the synthesizing, the making it digestible, was actually a very creative process to go through. You know, for certain issues, sometimes a clear structure presented itself. But more often than not, as a writer, you got to decide, you know, how do concepts best fit together? How will this make sense to my reader? What's the logical flow? Where does it make sense to divide up topics, or does it make sense to leave it as a larger issue? And so that process was really fun, and it was not something that I expected to get to do. And the third thing that I don't want to say it surprised me, but it was rewarding. You know, I always believed in the concept of this book and the gap that it was going to fill in the legal textbook market. But there were so many moments in the writing process where I said to myself, wow, this would have been super helpful on this file or that file. Or when I was dealing with an issue 2 years ago, I really could have used this chapter. So it was really rewarding to go through that and see the usefulness of the book come to life as I was writing. Jason, in the process of writing the book for you, I know this is not your first, I think it was your second book. I think that's right. Did you find anything particularly surprising or interesting this go around?
In fairness, the first book was an annotated legislation book. So it's a little different, certainly a lack of the same sort of critical inquiry that you've mentioned. But thank you. I will take this as my second book. I will take that. In terms of what I found surprising, a lot of the things you mentioned, Michelle, but one of the ones that I found interesting was often as lawyers, we are looking for a principle that will apply in the case that we have, or for a statement of the law, so we know what position we can take or what arguments we may have to raise. In writing the book, certainly that was part of it, but then there was also an opportunity to take a step further and dive into a critical thinking of, well, why is that the case? Why does that legal principle exist? And how does it fit with some of the other issues that may arise? So instead of simply just saying, here is a statement of the law from this court, in writing the book, there was an opportunity to say, here's a statement of the law. Here's why that principle is important. Here's how it fits with other principles. And here's how that principle has developed, or why that principle has developed. So certainly that aspect of building a puzzle as opposed to just taking the single piece and applying it in the case at hand. So that was certainly one thing that I found interesting, in putting that, as you've mentioned, different ways that the structure can fit together. And that often involved examining, well, why is this a principle that we need to talk about, and how does it fit with the others? So that was certainly an aspect that was interesting and surprising to me. And in terms of writing the book itself, there was certainly an interesting process in that regard, as sometimes I would sit down on a Sunday and start writing and things would just flow. It would be very easy to put the issues together, whether it was the topic or I had a good sleep or the coffee I had made was particularly good that day. So there was times when I would just work and the writing process was easy and you could really come together on a comprehensive, digestible chapter in an easy manner. I would like to say that's always the case, but it certainly was not. On other times, I would think that this is a topic that I know I'm going to start writing. So I'd start writing and then I would sit there and I'd type something out. I'd delete it. I'd type it out again. I'd delete it. Eventually, I'd get a couple paragraphs down and I'd say, okay, that's good enough, even though it took me hours. And then I would read it the next day and I would say, well, that was garbage. Why did I write that? So certainly that aspect of times when you really had a good understanding and the words would flow versus times when just nothing would come easily and you'd have to start over. So certainly that I understand, you know, writers talk about writer's block, and it does happen even in writing legal textbooks that the idea of the creativity or that synthesis of issues just isn't there. So that I found that dynamic process of writing not being linear, that was certainly something that was surprising when you're dealing with more critical issues.
Yeah, thanks for that, Jason. You know, your comment on when writing flows and when it doesn't, what I've learned over the years, at least for myself, is when it doesn't flow, to me, it's a signal to myself, I need to think more about this topic. I need to think deeper. I'm not ready to write. I need to refine my table of, or my structure for this chapter, think some more, reflect some more. And then sometimes then the words begin to flow. Let's move on to some substantive areas. I know that one of the things that the three of us have reflected on after writing the book is looking back over the many decades that this law has developed. What are some of the crucial developments in the case law? And I'll start off with talking about the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, because this was really a crucial development in the law of regulatory investigations. Because when the charter was introduced, there was great uncertainty as to what impact it would have on regulatory investigations. We know that the charter is focused on the unrelenting protection of individual rights and freedoms. And the Supreme Court of Canada has emphasized in the Vavilov case that administrative decision-making is one of the principal manifestations of state power in the lives of Canadians. By contrast, regulatory regimes are focused on government's view as to what is required for the collective good of society to address the realities and complexities of modern industrial society. So the issue was, okay, if we have a charter focused on individual rights, is this going to undermine the ability to conduct an effective regulatory investigation, which is really focused on the broader societal good? So if you think about the types of rights that are afforded to an individual facing a criminal charge, they have a right to remain silent during investigation. There's no right of the state to compel a statement. There's no duty on an accused person to cooperate during a criminal investigation. For the police to obtain a search warrant, there's a high standard that is required to be met in order to obtain documents and other evidence. And of course, at the criminal trial, there's no way that the state can compel an individual to testify. Now, if you contrast those sorts of individual rights in the criminal law context with a typical administrative process in a statute, there's no right to remain silent during an investigation. An investigated person can be compelled to provide a statement. There is generally a duty of cooperation on the investigation, either imposed by statute or the common law. Statutes will often provide for warrantless seizures of documents and other evidence. Not only can you be compelled to provide a statement, but those statements are routinely introduced at a hearing against the person's interests. And of course, at the administrative hearing itself, the investigated person can be compelled to testify. And the case is being heard by a tribunal appointed by the government without the degree of institutional independence that a judge would have in a criminal case. So these are two markedly different regimes, the criminal law regime and the administrative law context. And so the question was, which one was going to hold sway as the charter jurisprudence developed? And in a series of cases in the 1990s, the Supreme Court of Canada adopted an administrative law paradigm rather than a criminal law paradigm, holding that for the purposes of the charter, there needed to be differential treatment of regulatory proceedings and criminal cases. And the court was really persuaded by two different rationales to take that approach. First, the court in many cases has stated that regulatory regimes are of fundamental importance to our society. One of the most important cases in this regard, wholesale travel, the Supreme Court of Canada said this: regulatory legislation is essential to the operation of our complex industrial society. It plays a legitimate and vital role in protecting those who are most vulnerable and least able to protect themselves. The extent and importance of that role has increased continuously since the onset of the Industrial Revolution. So obviously here, given the importance of regulatory legislation in our society, the Supreme Court of Canada did not want to do anything that undermined the effectiveness of regulatory regimes. Secondly, the court said that persons working in a regulated industry are expected to know the rules of the game. That's the language that they use, the rules of the game. So if you're working in a regulated industry, individuals know that they are subject to the oversight and direction by their regulator. They know that they have a duty to account to the regulator who is acting in the public interest. And the Supreme Court of Canada has emphasized that in the context of the charter, regulated persons have a diminished expectation of privacy, which of course has driven the case law with respect to search and seizure in the regulatory environment. So as a result of this overall direction where the court issued a criminal law paradigm and applied an administrative law paradigm, the jurisprudence has developed such that the charter has not undermined the effectiveness of regulatory investigations in any significant way. So that's one of the major developments from my perspective. Michelle, what are some of your thoughts on important developments in the jurisprudence?
Well, Jim, one of the focuses for me in writing this book was on investigative powers, the nature of those powers, the scope of the powers that a regulator has when conducting an investigation. And while this is not a rapidly evolving or a newly evolving area of law, one of the most important things and one of the most important developments overall in this field is to understand that while there is great breadth and great depth to regulators' investigative powers, the law is recognizing and enforcing some limitations on those powers. And there's recent case law I'm going to mention briefly, talking about the need to constrain some of those powers within the statutory context. I mean, the state of the law in general, as the overarching framework, is that regulatory investigators have broad powers of investigation. This is a function of their enabling statutes, which provide wide-ranging powers, but also, Jim, as you said, a function of the Canadian courts confirming the importance of the role of regulators in the regulatory framework, the importance of the public interest, and the regulator's role in protecting that public interest. So it's critical to know, when that's the general framework that you're faced with, that there are some limits on that broad power. You know, this is critical for sure for regulators who are doing the investigations. They need to know and understand the boundaries of their powers. But it's also critical for lawyers who are practicing in this area, who are advising and assisting their clients who are subject to investigations by regulators. You know, and working from that perspective, which is the type of work that I do, assisting clients who are under investigation, it's my job, I see my job as their lawyer, to understand those limits, enforce them when a boundary is being crossed. And when we're looking at the tools we have to try to ensure that the proper powers are being exercised, or at least ensure they're being constrained within their appropriate scope, is to look at the statutory context that gives life to those powers. And some of the more recent case law in this area focuses on that and the need to connect those powers to the statute. A few of the cases that have come out recently, I mean, I say recent, in this area, a 10-year-old case, appellate level case, is considered recent, I will say, but there have been some more recent than that as well. But for example, there is a case from Alberta, I think it was a 2017 case, that dealt with an investigation into police officers' professional conduct. And in that case, the investigators had obtained sealing and production orders under the provisions of the criminal code and not under the powers of the legislation related to professional conduct. And so the court in that case found that those orders were not valid, as the investigators had moved from the purview of their enabling statute, that being the statute governing professional conduct, and relied on or attempted to rely on provisions that were not conducted to the heart of the investigation that was being conducted. As another example, in the context of document production and document compulsion, the Federal Court of Canada more recently considered the powers under the Income Tax Act to compel documents. The question was, did the provisions allow compulsion of pre-existing documents only, or could an investigator also require the person being investigated to produce information via written answers to questions? Obviously, that imposes a significantly higher burden on the person being investigated. And the court, in considering whether or not the power in the statute went that far, did acknowledge the importance of supervising taxpayers in the context of a self-reporting, self-assessing scheme. So, you know, getting back to the important role that regulators play in protecting the public interest. But ultimately, the court found that this particular statutory wording did not ground that larger power that the investigator was seeking to employ. So again, this is a court taking a hard look at the statutory language and saying, look, the power needs to have its source in the language of in the legislation. Another example relates to the power to seize evidence. You know, as Jim, you said, this is one of the, it's an issue that comes up. It's multifaceted, the limits on this power. There's questions of whether or not a warrant is required, whether the preconditions for the warrant have been met. There are also charter issues, as you mentioned. But another limit for this power is, again, the statutory context. And one of the cases we talk about in our text is a 2013 BC Court of Appeal case dealing with the Department of Fisheries and Oceans seizure of fish on the belief that they had been illegally caught. And because fish were perishable, the department sold the fish and then was seeking an order, a detention order for the proceeds from that sale. And in considering whether or not there were grounds to detain the proceeds from the sale, the Court of Appeal again took a really hard look at the statutory language. And in that part of the legislation, some of the provisions dealt with the further detention of fish and proceeds of sale, and some provisions dealt only with the further detention of fish and did not talk about the proceeds of sale. And in this case, what the minister was seeking to do was to rely on a provision talking just about the detention of fish and not the proceeds of sale. And so the court said, look, the power is simply not there in the statute. I understand what you're trying to accomplish here, and there's a public good and a public interest in that, but your power has to be in the legislation and it's not there. So this case, the others I've mentioned, I think it's important that these give support to arguments to try to limit the exercise or constrain the exercise of investigative powers to ensure that they are really connected to the statute. We know the overarching principle is that regulators have broad powers, but the case law that has developed and continues to develop, confirming and enforcing the limitations on those powers, I think is an important law, part of the law on this issue. So to me, that's one of the important developments.
Thanks, Michelle. And, you know, that just reminds me of a very interesting issue with respect to investigative powers. And that's the concept of crossing the Rubicon. So one of the really complex areas of the law with respect to the charter is what happens if a state official begins to exercise administrative powers? Let's say they stop a semi truck because they don't have all the lights on that they're required on the back. And they're doing an investigation and talking to the driver, but then they begin to think that something is a bit off, and they begin to think that maybe this driver might be transporting illegal narcotics, and they start doing a search and start using investigative powers that way. So there's a body of case law that we've addressed in the chapter on the charter as to when that police officer or that highway traffic officer would cross the Rubicon. And therefore, you know, because at some stage you have to shift from the administrative law context to the criminal law context with different rights and different responsibilities. So that's a really complex area of the law that I found very interesting in dealing with the chapter on the charter. Jason, what are some of your thoughts looking back as to some of the important developments in the jurisprudence?
So similarly, a lot of my interesting development shares some similarities to what you and Michelle have been talking about, Jim. A lot of this overlap or potential intersection between regulatory regimes and other aspects of law, including criminal proceedings. So certainly with the expansive scope of regulated regimes and the increasing broad scope of investigations and investigative powers, there's often times where the same conduct that gives rise to a regulatory investigation can also give rise to some other variety of proceeding, including a criminal investigation or civil litigation or even another type of regulatory proceeding, because oftentimes there may be overlap between regulatory regimes. So there's two separate issues arising. So the balancing of these different proceedings, in my view, has been an important development, given the interests that are at stake in all these proceedings, as well as the consequences that an individual may be exposed to, particularly in terms of potential criminal sanctions and potentially the use of information collected in one investigation being used in another proceeding, which may have additional consequences. In looking at the issues related to concurrent criminal and regulatory investigations, I was struck by the fact that there is generally a recognition, and this has been a development, that regulatory investigations should be allowed to proceed even while a criminal investigation is taking place. So oftentimes we think of criminal investigations as being certainly the most serious risk that an individual can face. But even here, where there is potential issues arising, courts have recognized that there is a need to protect the public interest and that a regulator should be allowed to proceed with its investigation to ensure that it is protecting the public. This is recognized in the test that states when an individual is seeking a stay of proceedings, so seeking to pause the regulatory process, that there is a need to establish that there is a sufficiently serious risk of irreparable harm. So it's not similarly limited to that there could be irreparable harm. It is that there is a sufficiently serious risk, which is measurable by whether the applicant can show that their fair trial interest in the criminal proceedings will be infringed unless an injunction is granted, which would stop the regulatory investigation from proceeding. So it's not just that there is the possibility of prejudice or risk, it is that there needs to be an establishment on a balance of probabilities that fair trial interests will be infringed. Certainly, the Supreme Court of Canada has said that if a regulatory authority is charged with a duty of promoting or protecting the public interest, and there is some indication that the activity sought to be enjoined was undertaken pursuant to that responsibility, then a court should, quote, in most cases, assume that irreparable harm to the public interest would result from the restraint of that action, end quote. So certainly there is this balancing that has developed where there is a recognition that if a regulator's objective in its investigation is paused too readily or easily, that can itself result in irreparable harm because the public could be put at risk if the regulator is not allowed to proceed with that investigation. That is being balanced with the issue of the individual's concerns about their trial in the criminal proceedings. But certainly it's an important issue of allowing a regulator to proceed unless there can be actual prejudice demonstrated that will arise in that criminal proceeding. So I've certainly seen that as an interesting development. In addition, also the use of evidence obtained in criminal investigations for use in a regulatory investigation has been an important development. So it's been recognized that that information can be obtained from the Crown themselves, but there can sometimes be issues with that. There can be privacy issues arising. There can be delay in having that produced by the Crown. So it has been recognized by the courts that a regulator can obtain all the information and evidence about an accused particular charge directly from that accused. If they have been made aware of that information through any sort of disclosure package in the criminal proceedings, courts have said, well, the regulator can go and obtain that information directly from the accused. And that has been a significant development, particularly given that there seems to be a continued increase in issues arising, particularly in professional discipline, around sexual misconduct. So we are seeing a lot of issues arising in a criminal proceeding, as well as in a regulatory proceeding around that issue of sexual misconduct. So if a regulator is able to obtain the information that it needs or that it thinks is relevant as part of its investigation from an investigation that has already been conducted by the police, that is a vital piece of a vital tool that regulators can use to obtain that information. And it can proceed with protecting the public interest even while that criminal proceedings are ongoing. Even if the trial hasn't been held yet, there is an ability for the regulator to obtain that information. Finally, one of the other developments I found to be of importance is the development around the use of documents obtained in either a regulatory proceeding or potentially in a civil litigation, and this concept of an implied undertaking rule. So this has been something that I largely took for granted as applying in regulatory proceedings, but the courts have given some pushback on that and have raised questions about really how broad is the implied undertaking rule when we're talking about a regulatory proceeding. So certainly while there is an implied undertaking that prevents the use of documents obtained in civil litigation in other parallel proceedings, the existence of such an undertaking is less clear with respect to documents obtained in a regulatory investigation, particularly if there's a desire to use information from a regulatory proceeding in a parallel civil litigation. And it is becoming more common to see parallel civil litigation as parties can be in disputes about contracts, about negligence, about these other issues around the same types of conduct that gave rise to a regulatory proceeding, as has been raised in the lawsuit. So certainly in some of these situations, there's a desire for litigants to take information used or discovered in a regulatory proceeding for use in a lawsuit. And in these circumstances, you know, there's a need for an effective investigation on behalf of the regulator. And that can come into conflict with the aims of civil proceedings, which is to seek and to ascertain the truth, which requires proper pretrial disclosure and discovery. So initially, some of the decisions stated that documents disclosed in a regulatory proceeding are clearly subject to the same implied undertaking that applies in courts. But in other decisions, including from an Alberta Court of Appeal decision, questions have been raised about the same type of implied undertaking and about whether the contexts are the same, whether there's an undertaking to the court, and several other issues. But even then, there has been a recognition of this implied quasi-undertaking of confidentiality. So these developments around what use can be made of information obtained in regulatory proceedings have been significant. And some of the tools that regulators can use to protect information disclosed in proceedings, in investigations, because there is a good reason to want to impose certain confidentiality obligations to that information, to impose restrictions on its use, to ensure that there's full discovery, a full investigation. So courts have recognized that there is a power for regulators to impose a more explicit undertaking, particularly in quasi-judicial processes that are adversarial, where there's some form of pre-hearing discovery. So that is certainly something that has developed and has been recognized for regulators, but really understanding where that disclosure limitations arise and where those undertakings or confidential obligations can exist, knowing the nuances around that and the developments that have occurred is certainly an important piece of regulatory investigations that I found to be quite interesting, and the developments of that to be quite interesting when I was dealing with that issue in the book. So, Jim, while we've talked about these developments that we found interesting, if you had to pick one issue that you would consider to be, you know, the hottest topic, as hot of a topic as there may be in the law of regulatory investigations, what do you think that would be?
Well, Jason, you'll be relieved that I'm not going to say standard of review and Vavilov, we're trying to keep this interesting, even though that's very important for administrative law lawyers. But for me, delay in administrative proceedings is the hottest topic in administrative law. It's extremely important. So the question is, when administrative proceedings are delayed, when would that justify a stay of proceedings or some other remedy due to an abusive process? So I'm going to address three seminal cases from the Supreme Court of Canada that took place in a 22-year period. The first is Blanco from 2000, then the criminal law case of R. and Jordan in 2016, and then the professional regulatory case, Law Society of Saskatchewan and Abramitz from 2022. So let's start with the Blanco case from the year 2000. So Mr. Blanco was a member of the Legislative Assembly in British Columbia. And two of his assistants filed complaints with the Human Rights Commission, alleging that he had sexually harassed them over the course of their employment before they quit. The Human Rights Commission made a decision to refer the complaints to a hearing, and that decision was made about 32 months after the original complaint was filed. Mr. Blanco then made a court application to have the complaint stayed due to unreasonable delay, alleging that the delay caused prejudice to him and his family. And the evidence was, of course, that there was a great deal of media coverage of these allegations against him. He had to resign from caucus. He thought that he could not run again as an MLA due to the negative publicity. And he said the delay and how long it was taking to get referred to a hearing caused him prejudice. He felt he had to move to another province. So he applied to enjoin the continuation of the human rights process before the BC Supreme Court. The BC Supreme Court looked at the charter issues because Mr. Blanco alleged a breach of Section 7 and also the administrative law issues and dismissed the application. That was appealed to the BC Court of Appeal, which clearly, if you read that level of judgment, they were quite appalled by the level of delay in this case. The 32 months thought that the investigation should be able to have handled very, very promptly. They relied on the charter, Section 7, found there was a breach and granted a stay. So BC Human Rights Commission then appealed to the Supreme Court of Canada, which allowed the appeal and allowed the human rights process to proceed. With respect to the charter issues, the court went through Section 7 and said, it's going to be extremely difficult to engage Section 7 due to delay. And they really focused on the administrative law part of the case. And they said that even if the charter is not engaged or not breached, delay can justify a stay. But there needs to be inordinate delay that has directly caused significant psychological harm to a person or attached a stigma, such that the human rights process would be brought into disrepute. And the court recognized that there can be two types of prejudice arising from delay. There can be hearing unfairness, such as, you know, where witnesses have gone missing, where memories have become impaired, where evidence has been destroyed. So that's one type of prejudice that can arise from delay. But the other part of prejudice is where there's no hearing unfairness, but simply a significant prejudice to the person. And the court said, if the delay did not cause hearing unfairness, then few delays will justify a stay. Now, as I indicated, the Supreme Court of Canada allowed the appeal, but it was a split 5-4 decision. And the dissenting four justices would have found undue delay, but they would have imposed a remedy other than a stay. And that dissenting decision was actually very influential 22 years later in the Abramitz decision. And as an aside, after the Supreme Court of Canada said the hearing rights process could continue, the matter did go to a hearing. In 2001, the Human Rights Tribunal made a finding that the assistant was sexually harassed and awarded damages. And that just illustrates that, you know, when a stay is granted because of delay, it comes at a huge societal cost. Namely, there is no adjudication of the issues. And here, this person who was innocent of causing any delay, they were the complainant, they would have had their remedy denied. But the Supreme Court of Canada said they could proceed, and they had a remedy from the Human Rights Tribunal. Second seminal case from the Supreme Court of Canada is R. N. Jordan, 2016. So, criminal law case, and the issue here was in the same, was in that context. When does a delay justify a stay of proceedings? And the Supreme Court had been looking at the issue of delay in criminal cases over a number of decades. And finally, they said, this is time for a new direction. And the reason we need a new direction is because there is a culture of complacency about delay in the whole criminal law process. And because of that culture of complacency, we are going to establish hard limits on the delay. And we'll have a presumptive ceiling for the length of time that a criminal law case can take. And if there's delay beyond that presumptive ceiling without exceptional circumstances, then generally a stay of proceedings is going to be granted. And you read about this in the paper every day about Jordan type cases. So after Jordan was released in 2016, every administrative law lawyer began to think, will there be an impact on administrative law proceedings? Because we know that many regulatory agencies across Canada struggle with delay for many different reasons. And many commentators have argued that there is a culture of complacency that has also developed in administrative proceedings. So if you looked at the type of delay that took place in the Blanco case, generally, human rights tribunals, as just one example, face much greater delays today. You know, I mean, in our practice, Ministry of Law lawyers, it's not that unusual that we're getting to a hearing before a privacy commissioner or a human rights tribunal 4 years after the complaint was filed, right? This is pretty extreme. And so all administrative law lawyers began to wonder if these principles in Jordan would migrate from the criminal law to the administrative law side. Now, courts took differing positions on that. For example, the BC Court of Appeal in a Diaz-Rodriguez case, which was a police discipline case, said, you know, Jordan's got no applicability beyond criminal law. Jordan is based on Section 7 of the Charter. Section 7 of the Charter does not apply to these administrative law proceedings. Therefore, it has absolutely no applicability. Other courts took an opposing view and said, yes, it's criminal law, but the principles can be applied in the general law, in the administrative law context. And this issue came squarely before the Saskatchewan Court of Appeal in the Law Society of Saskatchewan and Abramitz. There was a Law Society audit of Mr. Abramitz's practice that was raising red flags. And eventually discipline proceedings were initiated, went to a hearing after a protracted period of time. There's a finding of conduct unbecoming. And then on the sanction phase, Mr. Abramitz was disbarred by the discipline committee. And he then applied to the hearing committee for a stay of proceedings based on delay, arguing Blanco, but also arguing the principles in Jordan. There had been a 71-month delay between the audit and the discipline committee's stay decision. The Court of Appeal was very, very concerned about the length of the delay, and their analysis was animated by the public policy concerns about the corrosive effects of delay as set out in Jordan. And they were concerned about the culture of complacency about delay in administrative law proceedings and granted the stay. The Law Society appealed to the Supreme Court of Canada, which allowed the appeal and set aside the stay of proceedings. The court found that the 71-month delay was a serious concern, but that it was not undue in all the circumstances. And Supreme Court of Canada found that the sketch in Court of Appeal should not have interfered with the factual findings of the discipline committee with respect to who was at fault for the delay and whether there was significant personal prejudice caused to Mr. Abramitz by the delay. The court, in its decision, affirmed the conceptual framework in Blanco for assessing delay, but with some very important modifications and clarifications, which I'm going to review. The Supreme Court of Canada emphasized that there is an obligation on the party who's complaining about delay. And at the Supreme Court, I was honored to be able to represent the Law Society of Alberta, along with one of my partners, Katrina Heyman. And this is the point that we really emphasize, that investigative persons should not be allowed to wait in the weeds, because, you know, that's what happened in the Abramitz case. He waited in the weeds and then raised delay when it was tactically advantageous. And so we argued that investigative persons should have an obligation, if they're concerned about delay, to raise it with the regulator. And the Supreme Court of Canada agreed and said that as soon as a delay becomes a concern, the affected party is expected to use all available procedures to move the matter forward. And in most cases, they are expected to contact the tribunal and ask to move the matter forward. So that was a very important clarification by the Supreme Court of Canada, because it should eliminate the waiting in the weeds tactic generally. The court also said, with respect to the concept of Jordan, that the principles in Jordan should be applied, they simply said, no, we are not going to apply Jordan in the context of administrative law principles. Jordan was based on Section 7 of the Charter, and the court said there's no need to Jordanize Blanco. One of the important issues when determining delay is figuring out when the clock starts and when the clock stops for the period, for the purpose of calculating the length of the delay. Supreme Court of Canada said the time starts to run when the regulator's interests are engaged, which is sort of a vague test, but for most cases it's going to be based on when a complaint is received. Although in this case, in Abramitz, the Supreme Court of Canada said it started when the Law Society began to do its audit, because it knew something was wrong. And the end point, clock stops when the decision is issued. Now, this is a change in the law, because after Blanco, most courts which looked at this issue stopped clock running sometimes when it was referred to a hearing, sometimes at the start of the hearing, sometimes at the end of the hearing. It was not consistent, but here the Supreme Court of Canada said the clock stops, it keeps running until the decision is issued. So that's an important factor for the consideration of those agencies that have decisions that are subject to lengthy reserves by the tribunal. Another important point by the Supreme Court of Canada and Abramitz is that they said that delay can be waived by the investigative party, and it can be explicit or implicit. And here the case law prior to Abramitz was uncertain. Some cases said if a person kept silent and didn't object over the course of years and just let the process unfold, then they could implicitly waive the delay, giving up their right to complain about it. Other courts, such as the Alberta Court of Appeal in Stinchcombe and the Law Society of Alberta, said, no, you can't have implicit waiver. It has to be explicit. So you can't waive something unless you say, I'm okay with the delay. I won't raise it. And I view the decision in Abramitz as overruling that decision, and with the Supreme Court of Canada finding that delay can be both explicit or implicit. Supreme Court of Canada really focused on the importance of other possible remedies other than a stay of proceedings. The court recognized a stay of proceedings is very injurious to the public interest because it stops the whole regulatory process. It prevents an adjudication of the issue. But they said, you know, there can be cases where a stay may not be appropriate, but other remedies might be, and the threshold to grant these other remedies will be lower than that required for a stay of proceedings. So some of the other remedies that they mentioned that could be pursued, seeking an order of mandamus by the court to compel the administrative decision maker to move forward in a more timely way, an order for an expedited hearing by the agency, a reduction in sanction. So because of delay, whatever the sanction normally would be, reducing that sanction, or not awarding costs against an investigated person, even though normally they would have an award of cost against them, and making an award of costs against the administrative agency. So that's some of the key rulings from the Supreme Court of Canada and Abramitz. So what's the conceptual framework now as set out in Blanco as modified by Abramitz? I'm going to run through that from my perspective. So remembering that there are two types of delay that affects hearing fairness, and delay that does not, but that could constitute an abusive process. So if you're looking at delay that might be an abusive process, there are essentially five steps. The first is that you have to calculate the period of delay. So that question has four subsets. One, you got to identify the starting point for calculating the delay, usually a complaint, but it can be different. You have to identify an endpoint. That's number two. Supreme Court of Canada said it's when the decision is issued. Three, you have to determine an inherent time for a case of this type. In other words, how long should the case have taken? Because all cases take time. How long should it have taken? And then you subtract the inherited time from the period of delay, and that's the period of delay that can be considered. So that's step one. Step two, you have to establish that the amount of delay is considered undue or inordinate. Number three, you must establish that the undue or inordinate delay is the responsibility of the administrative agency. Many types of delay are caused by the investigated person, and you can only seek a stay or other remedy if the delay or a certain part of it is caused by the agency, not the investigated person. And number four, the undue or inordinate delay has directly caused serious personal prejudice. So there must be a causal effect here, because the Supreme Court of Canada in Blanco and in Abramitz recognize that there can be prejudice that's inherent in the nature of the administrative proceedings. There's always stress. There's often negative publicity. But that can't be considered. It has to be prejudice that flows from the delay itself. And then fifthly, the contextual circumstances are such that undue delay constitutes an abusive process. So those are the five elements. Now, if we look at the elements for establishing an abusive process based on hearing unfairness, the first three are the same. Namely, you calculate the period of delay. One, two, the amount of delay is considered undue or inordinate. Three, the undue or inordinate delay is responsibility of the administrative agency. And then the last and the different part is that the undue or inordinate delay has directly caused prejudice of sufficient magnitude to impact the fairness of the hearing. So when I look at these two cases and all the jurisprudence that came in between, that for me is the framework for assessing delay. So once Abramitz was determined, there was a massive sigh of relief from administrative agencies across Canada, because the belief was that the Saskatchewan Court of Appeal level made it dramatically easier to obtain a stay of proceedings. But I will say this, Abramitz is no reason for complacency by regulators about delay. Abramitz is considered to be a regulator-friendly decision, but the Supreme Court of Canada also noted that regulators are expected to ensure that processes unfold in an expeditious way, because that's what the public interest requires. It's in the public interest that it's that we have expeditious proceedings, in addition to being in the requirement of being fair to the investigated person. And the Supreme Court of Canada said that the lack of resources does not justify undue delay. And I will say that based on the jurisprudence, even after Abramitz, that the courts remain concerned about delay. In other words, they understand Abramitz, they understand the Blanco decision, but if there's undue delay and it's at a level where they think this is not good for our processes, they are looking for reasons to grant some sort of remedy. So no reason for complacency, a great decision for regulators. Delay continues to be a hot topic in administrative law. So that wraps up our podcast. I'd like to thank everyone for listening to our podcast, for Michelle and Jason for co-presenting with me. I'd like to thank LexisNexis for hosting this podcast, and most importantly, for the support of our book, The Law of Regulatory Investigations in Canada, which was published this past spring, and which is available at the online store for LexisNexis Canada. Thank you, everyone.